Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's April 21st. Currently 37 degrees here in Old Town Park City under partly sunny skies. And we're reporting 42 degrees in the Heber Valley. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Nate Larson filling in for Cedric this week. Hey, we've got a quick moving storm system on the way out this morning. Should see sunshine take over up in Park City, Heber Valley area into the afternoon. Temperature wise, about 53 for the high in Park City, 61 in Heber. Weather gets even better into tomorrow. We'll see clear skies overnight. Chilly temperatures, though, 35 for Park City, 59 for the high tomorrow. We start to see a bit more spring-like weather pattern towards midweek and the latter half of it, at least. Southwest flow will be in place, and we're going to see waves of moisture move into the area throughout midweek and through the end of the week. So that means a chance of some showers are expected throughout each day starting Wednesday. A high of 60 is expected Wednesday, so temperatures are going to stay mild with that southwest flow. Overnight lows in the upper 30s. Wednesday night to Thursday, a high of 58 on Thursday as well. So it's about a 50% chance of some showers. So not going to be a washout of the day as we get towards midweek. But that chance of moisture is going to hang on through Friday, even a slight chance into the weekend with temperatures starting to drop, especially on Sunday behind a front. Plan on temperatures hanging on near 60 Friday into Saturday, with Sunday dropping to 51. Overnight lows will be in the mid-30s. Could see a bit of a rain-snow mix on Sunday as well. For Heber Valley, temperatures jump from 61 today to 67 tomorrow. Overnight lows will be in the 30s. Plan on shower potential increasing on Wednesday as well. Again, not a washout of a day, but hit and miss rain throughout your Wednesday into Thursday. Temperatures near 65 on Thursday. Not much change temperature-wise Friday, Saturday. Still mid-60s for highs. Overnight lows in the mid to upper 30s. And we do drop on Sunday with a front moving in. We'll be about 57 for the high on Sunday. Overnight lows in the mid-30s. Might see a bit of a wintry mix, especially early on Sunday with those cooler temperatures. Leslie?
Okay, Nate. Thanks.
You bet.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Park City author Ron Schwartz. He'll tell us a little bit more about his public lecture this week at the Kimball Junction Library based on his new book, The Quiet Strength of Resilience. Later on, Youth Sports Alliance Development Director Ashley Laxo with an update on some youth sports programming, and Park City Golf Director Vaughn Robinson with details on the opening of the golf season as well as some upcoming league play. Then stay tuned for Mountain Money. Today's guests include Jan Olpen, owner of Dairy King, a staple of the Heber food scene for many years. Then a conversation with Jessica McLaren, owner of Mountain Town Olive Oil, about how the current trade uncertainty is affecting her business. Then a conversation with author Stephen Witt about his new book, The Thinking Machine, a fascinating story of Jensen Huang and the incredible technology he drove NVIDIA to develop. All of that coming up on Mountain Money, of course, heard every Monday between 9 and 10. Taking a look now at some local news, hundreds gathered at Park City's City Park Saturday to protest recent Trump administration policies. KPCW's Christine Weller reports similar demonstrations happened nationwide.
April 19th was a national day of protest for the 50-51 group, which stands for 50 protests, 50 states, one movement. Members began organizing mass demonstrations at the beginning of the year. The group says its peaceful protests are a decentralized response to the anti-democratic and illegal actions of the Trump administration. Local Democratic Party Chair Rory Swenson organized a demonstration for April 19th. Residents from the Wasatch Back and beyond attended, carrying signs with messages like, "The power of the people is stronger than the people in power." Swenson said the April 19th date was chosen for its historical significance.
April 19th, 1775, that was the day that we had our first skirmishes and battles for the Revolutionary War. Battles of Lexington and Concord, where a small group of colonials finally said, "No more, we're done."
Now 250 years later, Swenson said the assembled people were part of a similar movement, aiming to have their voices heard. The event hosted a range of speakers. Park City LGBTQ plus Task Force founder Cammie Richardson advocated for LGBTQ plus rights. She mentioned a law passed during Utah's 2025 legislative session that bans pride flags at schools and government property, as well as 2022 legislation barring transgender athletes from girls' sports.
"I have never felt fear being trans until now. This wave of hatred and violence is backed and emboldened by Donald Trump and his administration of hate."
Park City Community Foundation's Diego Zagara advocated for immigrant rights. He's a Park City local, U.S. citizen, and an immigrant. Zagara said he moved to the U.S. from Peru about 20 years ago, chasing opportunity. He mentioned headlines about students being detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement for raising their voices, and said he looks back now fearing he could have faced the same fate.
A government that detains young people for protesting, for organizing, and for expressing dissent. Folks, we call that authoritarianism, or as somebody yelled out, fascism.
Ski Mountaineer and 2024 Democratic nominee for Senate Caroline Gleick closed the demonstration, speaking against the Trump administration's agenda and issuing a challenge to the crowd.
So what do? We don't wait for someone to save us, we save each other. Because when Trump guts the CDC, we become the public health response, distributing supplies, checking on our seniors, sharing trusted information. If he silences teachers, we teach truth in our communities. If he strips away labor protections, we organize unions and we strike together.
She said the demonstration was just the beginning, and it will take many more strikes and protests to be heard. Summit County Councilmember Megan McKenna, former Summit County Councilmember Glenn Wright, Democratic Senator Nate Bluen, entrepreneur Susan Piper, defense attorney Greg Skordas, and former Lieutenant Governor candidate Rebecca Cummings also spoke at Saturday's demonstration in City Park. There were no counter-protesters. Protesters also gathered in Provo, Logan, and at the Utah State Capitol Saturday. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, part-time Park City resident and author Ron Schwartz will be speaking to the community this Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Kimball Junction Branch Library. That'll be followed by a book signing of his recent book, The Quiet Strength of Resilience. He joins me now in studio. Good morning, Ron. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Leslie. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how it came to be that you wrote the book.
So my father was a Holocaust survivor, as were my grandparents, and I live part-time in Dallas. And the Dallas Holocaust Museum has a speaker series, and obviously the speakers are getting older, frailer, passing away, and they wanted to develop me as a second-generation speaker. And so I went and I met with them. This is probably about 10 years ago, and one thing led to another. They helped me develop a presentation, and I speak regularly there, and now I speak all over the country. And when I started speaking, I didn't know, like, my father had told me his story growing up. I had heard it a lot, but I didn't know if it was a good story, a great story, an interesting story. And as I started speaking and I started getting all these questions, I realized it was a really interesting and compelling story, and I decided to write a book.
Okay. And the book, you said, was told me off air, was published in February.
In February,
so
yes.
So very recent. So what was that like for you growing up? I mean, it sounds like your father did talk about it quite a bit, because we often hear that it was just so horrific. Many people kept it to themselves.
Right. Yeah, a lot of survivors didn't want to talk about it. A lot of them wouldn't talk about it and then did in later years. My father was always willing to talk about it. And I couldn't hear it often enough. We used to, when I was a kid, we'd go to his parents' house for lunch on Sunday, and I'd be in the car, and I'd say, "Dad, tell me that story again. And he would always tell to me. So I grew up with it. And even though I had this sense of being the son of a Holocaust survivor, and even though I lived in a fairly Jewish neighborhood, my father was the only survivor that I knew existed. So, I don't know, in kind of almost a twisted, perverse way, I felt a little special. But it was definitely, it's been part of my identity since I was a little kid.
Certainly. Your dad was born when?
My father was born in 1926 in Ludwigshafen, Germany.
All right. So when he was able to leave, how old was he then? He was about what?
So he was 13.
Okay, and, doing the math quick here.
Yeah, and he, in 1939, and he came home from school one day, and his parents said, "You're leaving tomorrow. You're getting on a train. You're going to France. We're not going." He didn't speak any French. He went alone. And my grandparents at the time didn't know if they were going to be able to get out. They did later, but at the time, so when they sent him off alone to France, they didn't know if they were ever going to see each other again. I mean, I can't even imagine the trauma of that.
Yeah, was he the only child?
Yes.
Okay. Which is, and then where did he land in France?
So he spent about 3.5 years as a hidden child in France. There were people watching over him, and I now know who they were. My father didn't know anything, probably by design. They didn't want him to know in case he got picked up. And he moved around France. He was there 3.5 years, and he lived in 10 different places in those 3.5 years.
This was part of the French resistance then, right, where they were hiding?
Yes, there's a group, it's called OSE, and they were very connected with the French resistance and the French underground. And the money, I think, that paid for all this, the Rothschild family, which was a wealthy French family, they made their money in banking. They were Jewish. They had left France by this time, but they left money behind to take care of child refugees. And my father was a beneficiary of that.
All right. So he was in France then until the war ended?
No. So he was in France until the end of 1942. And then it was decided that France wasn't safe for any of these Jewish kids anymore. And he and four friends escaped into Switzerland. And that's a whole other story. Counterfeit papers, harrowing train rides, being picked up by Swiss border guards. And then he spent, but he ended up staying in Switzerland. He wasn't a citizen. He was a refugee, but he was safe. He wasn't going to be deported to a camp. And he spent the rest of the war in Switzerland until the middle of 1945, when the war in Europe ended.
Yeah, and when was he reconnected with his parents, who actually did spend some time, it sounded like, in a camp?
He reconnected. So the war ended. His parents got out, and they made it to England. So while my father is moving around France and Switzerland, they're living in London. But there was no way to get during the war to England. So, and then the war ended, and you would think he would have gone to England and reunited with them. He didn't. He went to Palestine. It wasn't Israel yet. It didn't become Israel till 1948. He worked on a kibbutz that grew oranges. He stayed there for about 9 months. Didn't like it at all. Hated it. He said it was very socialist, very communist. And then in 1946, he finally went to England and reunited with his parents. He's 20 years old at that point. He hadn't seen his parents since he was 13. I mean, I can't even fathom that.
Yeah. So, and then made the move to the States, or did he grow up there in Europe?
So he spent about 2 years in England. He had some jobs. He learned English. He didn't speak English when he went. And then he came to the States 2 years later in 1948. He came alone. His parents didn't come. He came first. He got settled in New York, in Manhattan, in a part of Manhattan called Washington Heights, which was filled with German Jewish refugees. And then my grandparents came like 6 months later. And so he met my mother in New York. My brother and I were born in New York. And so that's where we grew up.
Yeah. And you know, and I've heard of other stories of friends of mine whose grandparents had made it out of Poland or Germany. How was it that they knew, right, to get the heck out? Or was it a matter of just having the resources to get out, and many people didn't have that?
That's a really good question. So as time went on, as you went through the 1930s and into the early 1940s, it got progressively harder and more difficult to get out. They knew to get out. Like, you know, the situation, the Nazis passed all these decrees restricting Jewish life in Germany, and it got the level of seriousness kept increasing. Like, my father talks about this. I have in the video testimony, as a little kid, even before Hitler came to power, being called a Jew pig at school. So it starts with name calling. Then the Germans issue the Nuremberg laws, which, so now you have legislation restricting Jewish life. Then you have something called Kristallnacht in 1938, which was physical violence against Jews, and they incarcerated a lot of Jews. And then they took away their right. They couldn't be in business anymore, so they impoverished them. So you have throughout the 1930s, it's getting increasingly more serious to be a Jew in Germany. And the writing was on the wall.
Well, so again, they were able, at least they had the funding to put you on a train and get you, or your father somewhere. Yeah. The title of the book, The Quiet Strength of Resilience. Talk to me a little bit about that. It's a really interesting title.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought a lot about this. And when I think about my father, I think about how people say, kids are resilient and that kids bounce back. And my father, he didn't really bounce back. He bounced forward. Like, he kept going to the next place compliantly. That's probably why he survived. And I think about the resilience that took. But he did it, like I said, quietly. And I think it took an incredible amount of strength to do that. And so I took the quiet and the strength and the fact that he was resilient, and I put it together, and that's where the title comes from. And I think it characterizes him perfectly.
Yeah. I mentioned this is happening. You'll be at the Kimball Junction Branch Library Thursday at 6 p.m., and it was brought to my attention. This is known as Yom HaShoah. What's this?
So Yom HaShoah, Shoah is the Hebrew word for Holocaust. So when people talk about the Shoah, that's the Holocaust. Yom HaShoah is a Holocaust Remembrance Day, and it's about, it's tricky because how do you... This isn't really something you want to celebrate, but you do want to commemorate it and mark that it happened. So it is Thursday. Typically, facilities will do events, maybe not on that exact day, but around that area. But we picked the day, April 24th, and it's Holocaust Remembrance Day.
All right. Well, tell me a little bit about the presentation. You said that you've got some photos, you've got some video.
Yeah, so I have 5 hours of video testimony from my dad that I recorded about 20 years ago. So fortunate to have that. And I play clips of him talking during the presentation. It's part of my presentation. And then I've done a lot of research. I've been through Europe, through museums, archives, libraries, and I've gathered hundreds and hundreds of pages of original documents from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And I want to show every single one of them, but I can't. So I show some of them and parts of them just to, as they illustrate and help tell the story of what happened to my father. And that's all incorporated into the presentation. And I think it's a really engaging, interesting, and compelling talk.
Yeah. All right. So then after the presentation, you'll kind of a Q&A and then a book signing?
We'll do a Q&A and then a book signing.
All right. Any other book signings planned?
Yes. I have a book signing this afternoon at Dolly's Bookstore at 5 o'clock. It's 5 to 7. I'm excited about it.
Okay. And any more books in your future?
I have some ideas for some books. They're not Holocaust books. They're on different topics. And when I get closer, maybe we'll come back and talk about those.
Okay. All right. Anything else, Ron, you wanted to tell us about the book?
No, I just thank you so much for having me here to talk about it. I every time I speak, I feel like I'm honoring my father, and it feels really good. And I also think it's really important right now with the rise in hate and the rise in anti-Semitism to tell the story.
All right. Appreciate your time, Ron. Ron Schwartz. Again, he'll be at the Kimball Junction Library Thursday, 6 p.m., also at Dolly's tonight, 5 to 7.
Thank you, Leslie.
Well, there's usually a waiting list for a plot at Summit Community Gardens, but this spring, there are more than a dozen available for this growing season. Summit Community Gardens and Eats is all about building community through food. Executive Director Helen Nadel says not only do they offer residents an opportunity to grow crops in the garden, but the organization also offers hosts after-school and summer camps for kids, and it staffs the Food Pharmacy Program, which delivers foods to those who may be experiencing food insecurity. To pull all of this off, Nadel has just hired a new garden manager, Jess Collette,
who comes to us with a wealth of experience, both in tons of growing experience and gardening experience and farming experience, from large community farms to backyard gardening and helping people garden in their backyards, from a really amazing organization in Salt Lake called Green Urban Lunchbox. So lots of experience growing, like I said, with working with volunteers, working with members of the public, even working with kids. So she's really a perfect fit.
The garden will celebrate opening day on Saturday, May 3rd. Nadel says that there will also be about a dozen plots that can still be rented.
Growing in community provides a bunch of things. I mean, it does provide resources. It provides connection with other people. We have people growing from every part of our community, folks who are really using it as an important food source for their families, as well as people who are, you know, hobby gardeners who want to grow flowers and maybe some special herbs for their culinary use. So it's really, you know, it's one of the places in Park City where people of very, very different walks of life come together, and it's a shared activity that people can engage in. So that is really cool.
Nadel says that Collette will be teaching a class on how to garden at high altitudes on May 13 from 5:30 to 7 p.m.
We're going to be talking about working the soil, what kinds of soil amendments, what kind you might want to add to the soil to help your whatever you're growing to grow. A lot of the tools that you can use to help the soil, kind of stir up the soil in great, safe, healthy ways to kind of bring more of the natural microbiology that's in the soil to the to really support that. So using tools, when to start planting what, which I think is always the mystery here.
Plots can be rented online, and there are still some openings for the after-school program with scholarships available. You can see the link for more information at kpcw.org. In the studio now from Youth Sports Alliance, I have Ashley Latsko, Youth Sports Alliance Development Director. Good morning, Ashley.
Hi, good morning, Leslie.
Good. Let's see. So we've reported, of course, today is Park City Mountain's closing day, and YSA is involved. How so?
Yes, we are. We're really excited to be participating in Park City Mountain's closing day, along with the National Ability Center and SOS Outreach. The three of us are beneficiaries of their closing day party.
Oh, okay. So how's that working?
So activities will be taking place there all day. Starting at 9 a.m., there will be hot chocolate and donuts on the payday steps. And then from 11 to 2, DJ Maddie Moe will be playing tunes at the Legacy Deck. And then finally, beginning at 3 o'clock today, YSA will be out on the Eagle Plaza. There will be raffles, there will be a band, and it'll wrap up the ski season.
Okay, and then you mentioned you're the beneficiary. How is that happening?
Epic Promise is generously offering to match donations made to YSA, and every donor will receive a reusable cup along with it. Kona Beer will be there today, and they'll be making a donation from the sale of each Kona Big Wave beer sale.
Okay.
So please be sure to stop by and say hi, and we really appreciate the support of both Epic Promise and Kona Beer.
Great. And it looks like the weather is kind of clearing. It's going to be a nice ski day after all. Let's talk a little bit about your after-school programs. Those are up and running.
They are. We're rounding out the school year here. We've really had an amazing year so far. We've offered 182 total programs to students at 26 different schools this year. Programs have ranged from breakdancing to water polo to skiing and to mountain biking. We're most excited that we're on track to have had 3,150 students participate in our after-school programs this year. That's a 25% increase over last year. And roughly half of our participants receive scholarships or discounts. So we're able to provide discounts to school employees, first responders, siblings, thanks to our title sponsorship with Kodiak.
Great. All right, so their sponsorships help you make sponsorships available for other scholarships.
Yes,
awesome.
Exactly.
All right, so are there any other programs still to jump into?
Yep, there are. There's still a few programs that are available for sign up. There are opportunities to try new things before the end of the year. We have mountain biking available at all of our in all of our school districts. We also have an e-bike safety class, a first aid and CPR class in Park City. Wasatch also has an indoor climbing class, golf, sailing, and more. So please check out our programs at ysausa.org.
Okay, and there is a fee to the classes, but you do make it reasonable. I mean, if somebody needs financial help?
We do, exactly. The programs are accessible to all financial backgrounds. So please check out our website and apply if that's something that pertains to you.
All right. And one of those funding sources is the Stein Erickson YSA Opportunity Endowment. I think this is your biggest funding opportunity. And you use this, what, for the postseason competitions?
We do. We use the Stein Erickson YSA Opportunity Endowment to support our seven partner clubs. This year, we have just awarded $32,000 in the spring round of the YSA Dare to Dream Scholarships. These spring scholarships are need-based awards to help athletes attend postseason competition that they may have qualified for during their season. So a junior nationals or a junior worlds or an invitation-only camp that's sponsored by a national governing body. So it's something that they didn't necessarily plan on, but that they strived for in the season.
Okay. And is it the Jim Gaddis? What do you use that foundation or that endowment is used for? What
the Jim Gaddis endowment is used to support our after school programs, so that is the programs that we just talked about. So that's what the Gaddis endowment goes towards, and the Stein Erickson endowment goes towards our seven partner clubs for the more competitive athletes who are progressing through their sport.
Okay, so for this winter season, I mean, you'd already given away almost $150,000.
We have, yes. We're thrilled to say that we gave around just over $147,000 in scholarships this year to help athletes with their travel, with their training, and with their competition funding.
Okay. And one of those is figure skater Kate Presgrove. Tell us how she has received funding to move her sport along.
Yes, sure. So figure skater Kate Presgrove skis with the Figure Skating Club of Park City, and she is a prime example of how these scholarships really empower young athletes to stay and thrive in their sports. We've supported Kate in her figure skating journey since she was seven, having started at age two. This year, our support helped Kate compete at the National Collegiate Figure Skating Championships. And Kate is starting her freshman year this fall at Dartmouth, where she has earned a full scholarship. So a very exciting story. Kate has spoken very well on our behalf and is just a great example of how our Stein Erickson Endowment can support and follow an athlete through their competitive career here. And then we will be cheering Kate on as she heads to Dartmouth.
Okay. And then once kind of your school programs are over, how do you guys spend the summers?
Well, we spend the summers really planning and getting ready for fall programs to start up. We sort lots of gear. We go through all that and sort of regroup as we head into next year's programs. Doesn't give us much time off. We really start our next year's school programs in September. And we really head into the heart of our event season, heading into the summer. So that's where our focus shifts that time of year.
Okay. Jan's Winter Welcome, of course, coming up. You've got a date picked for that already?
Correct. Jan's Winter Welcome is Saturday, October 25th, back up at Stein Erickson Lodge. It'll be the 45th annual Jan's Winter Welcome. So please keep your eye out for information. Tables and tickets usually go on sale pretty soon here. So check out ysausa.org for more information.
Okay. And in the meantime, you'll be out at the plaza there at Park City Mountain there at Park City Mountain Village.
Yes, I'm heading over there right now for hot chocolate and donuts on the steps, and hopefully we can see you out there today. Please come join us, especially this afternoon, for the party at 3.
Okay. Hey, thanks for coming in, Ashley.
Great. Thank you, Leslie.
Well, spring means warm weather, new flowers, and for some, the return of seasonal allergies. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more on the area's air quality.
With the constant change in weather, the start of the spring allergy season can sometimes be hard to detect in the Wasatch Back. Summit County Health Director Phil Bondurant says listening to your body can sometimes be the best bet.
I think the greatest indicator is if you wake up and your eyes are red and your nose is running.
Another data point Bondurant said people can look at is air quality, specifically PM2.5, the measurement of fine inhalable particles with diameters that are generally 2.5 micrometers or smaller. Air quality monitors measure concentrations of PM2.5, which represents a mixture of chemical species, including pollen, that can penetrate the respiratory system to trigger health problems.
We don't differentiate in that PM2.5 what is being picked up. We just know that there's additional particulate matter in the air. It's a tough time of year, right? We celebrate the warmth and we celebrate new growth and flowers and all the beautiful things that come with spring, but there is a little bit of drawback with that extra pollen in the air.
According to the federal government's air quality monitor, the Wasatch Back is currently at healthy levels. Salt Lake City and a portion of southwestern Utah, including St. George and Cedar City, are at moderate air quality levels. Under that level, people who are unusually sensitive to particle pollution are advised to consider reducing their physical activity and time spent outdoors. More information about air quality can be found online at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, fireworks will be banned in much of Wasatch County this summer. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports on this year's fireworks restrictions.
In general, fireworks will be allowed in high-density areas like downtown Heber and Midway, but prohibited on the outskirts of town and in the unincorporated county. Wasatch Fire District Fire Marshal Clint Nearings says the map of restrictions is designed to prevent open flames or sparks in the areas most at risk of wildfire.
So this map in the county area does follow the wildland urban interface map that has the highest propensity for a large loss fire.
Wildland urban interface is basically the area where development and wilderness meet. That means homes are in close proximity to wildfire fuel, so they're at higher risk of burning should a fire start. Much of the Wasatch Back falls in that zone. Heber City Councilmember Mike Johnston said he'd be happy with even more restrictive fireworks rules.
Some people say this is a restrictive map. Other people will say, oh, this is a map of where I can go shoot them off.
He asked the Wasatch Fire District to consider expanding the restrictions to areas like Snake Creek and Dutch Hollow. Leaders from municipalities, including Heber and Midway, as well as the Wasatch County Council, signed off on the map. The restrictions allow for exceptions around the 4th of July and Pioneer Day. To see the map of where fireworks are prohibited, visit kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
And some Colville City Council members are unhappy with their city attorney and planner. Last Monday, council members proposed an ordinance that would extend their power over both departments. KPCW's Connor Thomas explains.
Councilmember Lynn Wood introduced the controversial ordinance at the city council meeting April 14th. She says it's to help the city handle future challenges.
We have some big items looking at us as far as annexation and growth. And we realize that we need to look at our structure and how we are obtaining our professional advisors.
However, residents at the meeting thought it would upset the Colville government's separation of powers.
The proposed adjustment is nothing but a personal retaliation against current city officers. It is the result of a feud between sitting city officers and a portion of the currently impaneled city council.
The ongoing feud resident Matthew Boyer is talking about came to a head last year when council members Wood and Louise Willoughby objected to a decision other officials made. Mayor Mark Marsh, City Attorney Sheldon Smith, and Community Development Director Don Sargent allowed the nearby gated resort community of Wahali to list its short-term rentals for sale. Wood and Willoughby said the council should have voted on that. In February, the council came close to voting on whether to fire the city attorney. The mayor said then he's in charge of employment, so a vote to remove Smith would not be legal. The council didn't take a vote after all. It already votes to confirm mayoral appointments, but it doesn't get to choose whom it's voting on. Now the council's discussing giving itself that power, the right to appoint the attorney, and a new position called strategic planning director.
I feel like those positions are extremely important to the role that the city council plays in our legislative ability, more particularly the strategic planning director, although the city attorney certainly has a huge role in that. Well, that's exactly what we're doing is we're creating laws. but probably to a greater degree the strategic planning director.
But some residents cried foul, saying it's a separation of powers issue, shifting power from the executive to the legislative branch. Municipal offices are nonpartisan, but resident Rory Swenson says the ordinance still politicizes administrators.
Our city employees are not politicians. They are career professionals who serve the city, working with administrations of all kinds. They rely on a clear administrative chain of command to do their jobs effectively, ethically, and without fear. But this ordinance creates a structure where any single employee must now weigh the shifting winds of five different political agendas, five personalities.
Sargent, who's the only current planning official, says there's no need to add a position because his duties aren't full-time as is. And Denise Smith, the city attorney's wife, would prefer the mayor to stay in charge of city employment. She quoted Plato at the council meeting, referencing the ancient philosopher king ideal.
Only those who do not seek power are qualified to hold it.
Parts of the discussion were high-minded, other parts devolved into arguments. Councilmember Willoughby got emotional, saying she's collected public attacks from Denise Smith into a folder.
I dare any of you to run for city council. I dare you to be the butt of the harassment that I have been. And what is worse, nothing has been stopped. Nothing. It's been allowed.
Allegations of a power grab flew in both directions. Willoughby read a comment from longtime city official Steve Richens. Richens says previous mayors had disbanded committees council members sat on so they could get what they wanted at the time. He thinks the council should be more involved in day-to-day affairs. Here's Wood.
The major sticking point, well, really probably the only sticking point, is the fact that a changing of appointments. And that is something that we could easily change.
The rest of the ordinance codifies the status quo. The mayor proposes a new hire and the city council votes on it. The city council decided not to take action on the new ordinance yet. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Good morning. Well, the Park City Golf Course and Driving Range opened on Friday. In the studio with details about this year's play, I have golf manager Vaughn Robinson. Good morning, Vaughn.
Good morning. Nice to be here this morning.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So how did the course fare over the winter?
You know, it came through really well. The golf maintenance staff rebuilt all the booms and everything and for spraying for the snow mold we've been getting over the last few years. And the greens came through really nice, and the golf course is good condition considering the winter we had.
Yeah, and I was kind of curious just about, I mean, does it do better when there is more snow? It sounds like it did okay with kind of the weird winter we had. I mean, we had a couple of inches, and then we'd have a freeze, and then we'd have a thaw, and then a couple more inches, and a three and a, you know, freeze and a thaw.
Sure. Yeah, there's always concern with ice damage when we get those freeze and thaws. The best years typically is if the ground freezes before we get a snow, and then we usually, if we can get a 2-foot blanket of snow that stays there all winter, it's ideal for the golf course. So when we start getting that melt and warm, and then more snow, more freeze, typically you get different challenges from it. But we did get a layer of ice that was probably 2-3 inches. We went out there, chipped it off, and it came through pretty good. So.
All right. Do you still get out there and put fertilizer down
so,
to help melt?
Yeah, we used to use what they call Milorganite, and then kind of has a nice smell to it, but it's nice and organic, so that's the positives of it. But we go out there with black sand, which is just drawing the sun's heat to help Mother Nature and do a lot of the work for us. And then when it melts down far enough, we'll clear it with shovels if we need to.
Okay. Yeah, and it sometimes actually helps aerate too, right, the sand?
Yeah, it top dresses it, and we always aerify when we open up for the spring, which is a necessary evil. So they came through great. We destroy them, and then they grow back beautiful in a couple weeks.
All right, so best prices to golf are now through Friday before Memorial Day. Do you offer these kind of preseason discounts just because there's fewer players or just...
Mostly because of the conditions of the course. You know, they're not what we expect or we feel most proud of. So we keep the lower off-season rates just for the conditions of the course. And then once it's back in shape, we go to that in-season rates, which helps keep us viable, right?
Yeah. Okay. So have the prices been set for this year?
We took two options to council. We had a big discussion. We've leaned towards one. We've narrowed it down to one. We will be bringing that back fully, maybe even this Thursday. I think Hans is coming back from budget with the fee schedule. But it is a process that truly doesn't get adopted until June with all the fees throughout the city.
Okay, so will there be a price increase, though? Is that usually what happens?
Yeah, so, you know, we have long-term, we have a irrigation redo that's necessary. That's going to be $8 to $10 million. So we got to start kind of building some funds up for that. We do have an increase in our water consumption fee. It's with, you know, $90,000 to $100,000 this year. They're going to phase it in over 3 years, try to get somewhere between that $200,000 and $300,000, depending on how much water we use. So, yeah, we have to structure those fees accordingly to try to make sure that we stay the enterprise fund and make ends meet.
All right, so that new irrigation system will probably help with the water delivery, right?
Yeah, definitely. It'll create some positive opportunities. The negatives, obviously, is, you know, how do you shut down the course? Do you play through it? Do you shut down 9 holes? Do you shut down all 18 holes for a year? Every course has a different strategy on that. We haven't devised exactly how we would do it. Odds are we'll probably play through it just because we're muni, as we call it. But it'll create some opportunities, definitely using more water-friendly heads. Water consumption will be at the front of the mind. We can do a lot of redesign of holes or grains or something possibly during that time, depending on, you know, what route we take if we shut down the golf course.
So when is that construction project slated for?
Probably necessary within the next 3 to 6 years. We keep trying to push it as much as we can. We've had a lot of construction on the course, whether it, you know, the golf maintenance building, the treatment plant, which is, you know, all positives for the community in the end, but trying not to just be doing construction every year on the golf course, let people play golf. Yeah. So,
And the, you know, the city likens the golf fund as an enterprise fund, basically meaning that you need to bring in what you spend. And so because of the increased water costs, because of the capital projects, that's why we're starting to see that the fees get increased then.
Right? Sure. Yeah. Yep, exactly.
All right. This year, it sounds like you are bringing back a season's pass, but only for those living within city limits, 84060?
Yeah, correct. So council's prioritized kind of, hey, let's take care of those who live in town, make sure that their amenity is available to them, making sure we have open tee times for them. And one of the benefits they want to see is this season pass. It's the pricing of the season pass will be $1,350. It's based off of 30 rounds played. It does not include a golf car. So if they want to ride, they'll pay that riding fee each time they come in. But
all right. And then once they hit that 30 rounds, and do they still get to play?
Then it's all gravy, right? So they could, yeah, there's not a restriction on the number of rounds. But if you're going to play 20 rounds, you can major, it might not make sense to get that pass. But if you're going to play 35, 40 rounds, yeah, you get a little bit more of a discount.
Okay, I got it then. And again, you can go and just play 9 too. It doesn't matter.
Sure.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right. How many do you expect to sell?
That's a great question. So I'm guessing between at least 20 to 50, but I really don't know that just because we don't have any data from the past on that one, right? The last time we had season passes available for everybody was like 2001.
Right. Yeah. And then you stopped them just because so many people have them?
Yeah, so we grandfathered them, I guess we called it back in the day. So we had 122 that purchased them back then, but there were quite a few people that were playing 90 to 120 rounds. And it kind of, as an enterprise fund, didn't make sense as far as revenues coming in, right?
They're getting their money's worth, yeah. We also have 84060, of course, out at there at Deer Valley East Village, but they need to be, you know.
Yeah, I'm working on that. I've always called it 84060. We're working on the exact terminology, but basically the taxpayer in Park City, whether they live here or own their house here and it's a second home, if they're paying taxes inside Park City municipal limits, that's who we're gearing this towards.
All right. You're also offering a senior punch pass. This is what, for how many?
So the senior punch pass is either 10 18-hole rounds or 29-hole rounds or any combination thereof. So, and that will be for the school districts, the men's and ladies associations. So to give them, if they're outside the city limits, they can get a reduced rate. should be $600 for that pass. That does not include a cart, but it saves them $30 off the 110 for 18 holes with a cart that we plan on going to.
Okay, and then you also have a junior pass, basically the same price.
Junior pass is cheap. It's $425, and I couldn't tell you the last time we changed that price because it fits the community and builds future golfers, and people love it.
Yeah. You have a lot of junior golfers?
We do. We have a couple camps during the year that we have usually 50 to 60 kids in each camp, so... 110, 120 kids there. We have about 25 kids that do our teen camps, roughly around 100 that do our junior league, which is every Monday afternoon. So there's quite a bit of kids. I think last year we had 30 junior season passes that were sold.
Oh, great. And any changes to the golf course this year?
So the biggest thing we're going to do capital improvement wise is we're going to redo the cart pass. A lot of the tree roots have grown up and lifted and created those humps and bumps. So we're going to grind that down and redo a lot of the cart paths out there to smooth them out. And the other big thing we're going to do is a nursery green after the last 4 years of that snow mold. It's like, hey, if we have a nursery green where we can harvest some of that green or the grass and move it over, that would be very nice for the course.
Okay. So is it still a par 72, the course? I mean, given all of the shortening of the course due to the buildings that were...
Yes, we're back. So last year we went back to a par 72. Hole number 11 was a par 3 during the construction of the water treatment plant, just so they had area and space to create that. But last year we got 11 put back to where it was, and we're back as a par 72.
Great. All right, let's talk a little bit about league play. You have men's and women's, 9 and 18?
Correct. So... the men's league's kind of combined, so it's one fee to join that league. There's usually 220 members in the men's league. It's $80 to join that. They play on Wednesdays, usually from about 9:30 to 1 o'clock. We have 18-hole play, and then from 3 o'clock to about 4:30 or 5, depending on how many players we have in that 9-hole side of it. We block out tee times for them on that as well. And then usually one Sunday a month, they have a men's league tournament in the morning. So the ladies' league plays on Tuesdays. There's two different leagues. So the 18-hole league is $60 to join. They usually play from 9 to about 11 on their tee times. And then there's the 9-hole league. They go from first thing in the morning till about 11 o'clock for the 9 holes. And then they start back up at 2 o'clock and go till about 6:30, and theirs is $50 to join. I think there was 260 ladies in the 9-hole ladies league last year. They're expecting around 300 this year, so if it's not the biggest in the state, it's dang close.
All right, and registration is underway for those?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Do they do it at the golf course?
They can come in the golf course. We have forms there. They can go on parkcitygolfclub.org, click on the ladies league, and that form's on there as well.
Okay. Now, you mentioned you had, group lessons for juniors. Do you have them for beginning adults as well?
We've never had camps for the adults. We do have some people that will throw four or five folks together and do some group lessons amongst their friends with an instructor. So that's all available. There's four or five instructors at the golf course that can do individual private lessons or, two people together or up to five usually before it gets kind of not helpful to them and
right.
As far as getting the quality of instruction.
Okay, so including yourself, you have four other golf professionals, five of them?
Yeah, so you have Nate, Sean, and Sean, and then Cynthia's snuck back teaching a little bit here and there recently as well.
Yeah, and what does it take to be a golf pro?
Well, that's a great question. So the first thing is usually go take your player's ability test to get through the PGA stuff. And then they have some schoolwork that you can go through. There's others that have just over time done work. So work experience, they've mentored under some other pros and learned how to teach. There's books. So there's lots of avenues. There's also some golf instruction colleges, the Golf Academy of San Diego and that kind of stuff. There's a lot of private two-year degrees you can get as well out there now.
Yeah, so a similar certification to, say, like a ski instructor? I mean, is that what it requires?
I would say similar to that. They may I don't know exactly how the ski instructors' qualifications get. I do know they have some tests. Theirs might be a little more stringent than a golf pro. So,
okay, and just playing a lot of golf. You know, yeah, all the rules.
You don't have to be great. You have to be good, right? They say they want you to have a reputable game. But, you know, a lot of good players might become great instructors. A lot of great players continue to play.
Yeah. Okay, in your experience, I mean, what's the number one mistake of a beginning golfer?
For me, I would say that what I always tell all my students, the most important piece in the golf swing is holding your finish. And people look at me funny because the ball's gone, everything's done. But if you have balance, you have that rotation, if you finish in the same spot, that's going to start to bring that repetition to the golf swing. And repetition's more important than having perfect form, because at least you'll be able to play. You might not maximize your distance, but you'll be able to play and have fun and start to hit consistent shots.
Okay. And do you have is there a book or maybe a YouTube channel that you recommend that for people who may want to improve their golf game?
The only books I've ever read were more from Bob Rotella, which is Golf is Game and Not a Perfect. It's more of a mental side of it, because they, you know, we all tease that golf's 90% mental. And so those are great to do, but there's lots of YouTube stuff out there. I would just caution you to, sometimes you are getting information that may not pertain to you. It's great information, but it might not fit to your swing.
And that's how the golf professional can help. They can analyze the swing and see what you are doing correctly or
yeah,
not.
They can definitely hone in on the key area that will advance you the fastest.
Okay. All right. Golf's open. People can make reservations or tee times, 7 days in advance?
So it's actually 9 days in advance at 7 p.m. Utah time.
Okay. Is that an extension of?
It's always said 8, but the computer's always been 9, so we fixed it to where the verbiage is right. And then if you are a Park City Municipal resident, please pop into the golf shop, let us know, and you will be able to do it 10 days in advance.
Okay, Vaughn, anything else you want to mention?
No, I think we're great. Thank you.
All right. Hey, thanks for coming in.